I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 10, Buzzing Neon.
Dear Matt, let me ask you about something that I'm told entertainers just love. Critics. You've had to deal with them, I'm sure. I wonder, what was the roughest review you ever got? Who was the toughest critic you ever had to face? Writers also deal with critics, of course. I once got a brutal review from a guy named George V. Higgins, a crime novelist who wrote, among other books, The Friends of Eddie Coyle. Higgins' day job was doing media criticism for the Boston Globe, in the course of which he reviewed a new magazine of which I was the very young, very inexperienced editor. He didn't exactly lavish a lot of attention on it. His write-up, in its entirety, went like this. City Lights isn't very good. The most cutting thing about this, to me, was how short it was. In its magisterial brevity, it said that Higgins, a busy and successful guy, couldn't really be bothered to say much more. The fact that he couldn't even be bothered to get the name of the magazine right, it was City Limits, not City Lights. Well, that was just gravy. This was the second toughest review I ever got. The toughest was any review I ever gave myself. I know. We've arrived at a cliche, the one about being your own harshest critic. But as we've observed on this podcast before, there are cliches for a reason, right? David Bowie said all cliches are true. And who am I to contradict the Thin White Duke? Fantastic nickname, by the way. This one is true for me, at least. And I do think it holds true for most people. I've been thinking about why that is. Where does that self-critical harshness come from? Partly, I think, it's that the criticism we give ourselves lands first. We may not be our own best critics, but we're undeniably, each of us, our own first critics. There's a quote from another musician, the violinist Jascha Heifetz, nickname the Pudgy Pale Lithuanian, that puts this neatly. If I don't practice one day, I know it. 2 days, the critics know it. 3 days, the public knows it. Another way to say this, in the quiet of our own heads, the judgment we render on our own work is unmediated and direct. And it can be, because it can afford to be, impolite. There's another thing at play here. That early look we give our work from within our own minds, our own creativity. By definition, it's unfinished work we're looking at. It's easy and it's tempting to render judgment on it as if it were finished and complete. And the opposite holds true, and it's maybe even more germane. It's very, very difficult not to render judgment on unfinished work. This is a trap many creative people fall into. I live in a two-writer household, and one of the things Jennifer has brought to it is the concept of the vomit draft, which may be inelegantly named, but is highly descriptive of the draft you do where you just want to get stuff out of your system. The vomit draft is designed to forestall any self-criticism at an early stage, where it can be not only unhelpful, but even destructive, because self-criticism leads to self-editing, which at an early stage is pernicious. Get it out, put it down, move on. There will be time to come back and look at it later. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying there's no place in creativity for being your own critic. I'm saying there's a time where that scrutiny is usefully applied, and a time where it isn't. And time itself is a key to this calculus. The earliest piece of writing advice I ever got from a professional writer came from a woman named Sunny Decker, who lived in my neighborhood in Philadelphia, and was a local celebrity for having written a memoir called An Empty Spoon. Sunny knew I was interested in writing, and she took me under her wing. I was about 12, I think, when she told me to take my just-finished work and put it in a drawer, and not, under any circumstances, look at it for a while. She knew that this interval was what made meaningful self-criticism possible. I didn't get it then. I was baffled by it. but I've never started a writing project since without thinking about it. I've never done a piece of writing since that didn't benefit from it. Be your own critic, to be sure. Just not too soon. I keep meaning to tell you, by the way, how much I've been enjoying your videos on YouTube. They've been making me want to get a camera drone, and a visual sense, and a work ethic. Maybe I should start with the drone. I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill, you're right, of course, when you say that I might have had some, let's say, experiences with critics. But here's the thing. I was lucky. During the period of my career when I was still finding my feet and my voice and working everything out, I was a street performer, and critics don't generally review street performers. So I managed to spend the first 15 years or so of my professional life kind of flying under the radar. Once I graduated to venues with, and I'm going to use a technical showbiz term here, ceilings, I already, to an extent, kind of on a good day, knew what I was doing. So there wasn't the naive fresh meat to be ripped apart by those whose job it is to do that. I did once get reviewed as a street performer. Well, not quite a review, more a notable quote from legendary British actor Michael Gambon, your actual Dumbledore if you're a Harry Potter fan, who watched me work just outside London's National Theatre and said to a friend of mine, "Bloody brilliant, I couldn't fucking do that." Once I moved indoors, though, I did occasionally attract some column inches, and I do have some favourites, mostly because of how much they annoyed me rather than their level of cruelty. The short-lived circus arts magazine The Catch sent someone to review a club that I was hosting, which, in the resulting review, produced the immortal line, "You either love or hate Matt Ricardo. I quite like him." When I played a 5-week gig at the Adelaide Fringe in Australia, I got precisely one review. Luckily, it was in the newspaper that everybody wanted to be reviewed by. Unluckily, they sent their property page editor, who knew about as much about the nuances of comedy, circus, and theatre as I know about the ins and outs of fixed-rate mortgages. Her review topped out at a shade under 100 words, and the closest she got to analysis was saying that she liked my spoons. During the same season, I had in my audience a lady so drunk on the white wine she was clutching in her fist that she fell asleep and slowly, during the show, slid off her chair to the floor and began to snore. When I was a street performer, the harshest critique was, of course, to lose your audience. And it happens. A few people walk away, then a couple more, then the energy starts to go out of the whole thing, and then your entire crowd has lost faith in you and is drifting away in dribs and drabs like a sandcastle being eroded by the sea. There is no, I repeat, no worse feeling than finding yourself midway through a show without an audience and having to slowly pack up your stuff surrounded by the most clear, unavoidable, definitive sign that you've failed. Okay, there is one worse feeling. Once, I was doing a street show at Covent Garden in London, my regular pitch. 300 people gathered around me in a neat circle on a Saturday afternoon. Lovely. Then, a woman pushes her way through the crowd to my left. She walks to the centre of my pitch, acknowledging no one. She drops her underwear. She hikes up her skirt, and she takes a dump. Once finished, she pulls her knickers back up, straightens her skirt, and walks out of the right side of my audience, who, wide-eyed, give her space to leave. There is no comeback to that heckle. There's no counter-argument to that critique. That day, she won. But you're right, of course. No critic, not even a lady using my show as a bathroom, is as powerful, as potent, as cut to the quick effective as the critic that lives in my head. Oh, good luck to any external critic doing as much damage as my subconscious. They don't know the words of my parents that hang in my head like a blinking neon sign of no confidence all the time. They don't know the continual effort it takes to stop the slogan of my soul from being Homer Simpson's famous advice of "Can't win, don't try." But the internal critic, once it's had enough therapy, can be of use. There's a difference between being your own harshest critic and seeing yourself from the outside. And it's important to be able to do that. Like the song says, I never knew what my house looked like until I took a walk outside. That's also what putting your writing in a drawer for a while does. It helps you stop being inside it. So when you read it again, you're a little more like a reader rather than the writer. In my opinion, it's one of the most important things that anyone who makes art for an audience should do, to try to know how they or their work is seen. But that has to be held in delicate balance with the simple core process of having an idea and saying, screw it, and just doing it and finding out. And that's kind of what I try to do on my YouTube channel, since you were kind enough to mention it. I'm aware that I don't get stratospheric hit counts, but I make things that I want to make. I enjoy the process, and the people who watch seem to like what I'm doing, so great. If I wanted to have millions of viewers, I'd be posting videos unboxing Nazi memorabilia while spreading anti-vax messages in Minecraft. Look, I'm not going to lie and say that I ignore all critics. When I get positive reviews, it's nice, it makes me feel good, it's a compliment. If I wasn't shallow enough to enjoy the feeling of strangers liking me, I would not have got into show business. But on YouTube, I'm not doing it for the likes and the views. And in my live work, I'm not doing it for the critics. Like Walt Disney said, I'll take my chances with the public. I just prefer that they use the bathroom before they come and see the show. I'm curious to know what neon signs hang buzzing in your head, and if you ever found the off switch. Talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, as it happens, I do have a neon sign that hangs buzzing in my brain. It's a big L-shaped one spelling out the word hotel in blinking characters, one of which burned out years ago and was never replaced because down this gritty dead-end street, no hope for the future has ever walked. So what would be the point? Also, there's a jazz combo playing, something bluesy, the lead carried by a mournful, muted trumpet. Did I mention that in my brain I'm a character in a 1940s B-movie? No? Forget to mention that? It's true, I am in my head a character in a 1940s B-movie. I admit this may make it sound like I haven't taken your question seriously. To which I can only say, scram, Chester, hit the bricks. Huh. This episode has taken a turn, hasn't it? Well, let me see if I can wrestle it back onto the rails. Your buzzing neon sign blinks out your parents' disapproval and your own self-doubt, which brings us to another aspect of self-criticism. We deliver our most profound insecurities to it. Here's yet another reason why self-criticism is a hard thing to wrangle. But I'm here to tell you there's good news. It can be wrangled. Doing so is largely, I think, a function of experience. Experience gives you the ability to parse what you're thinking, to sort it into what's useful and what isn't. This is a tricky thing because the demands of every piece of work are different. The scale that gauges success is a sliding scale. We've talked about this in another episode. But after a while, you do get smarter about what different work products require, and this gives you ammunition to use against the yammerings of your own insecure brain. Which is a good thing, because, as you say, those voices never really go away, but they can be put in a box. I'm lucky in this respect, because, as I mentioned a minute ago, I live in a two-writer household. I get to hold the dark mutterings of my own mind up to the more dispassionate judgments of my wife, who is an excellent writer and editor, and see where they line up and where they don't. We have a system for when we give each other our work to read. The reader will always ask the writer, what kind of read are you looking for here? The writer will answer, I want you to look at the structure. Does it hold together? Or, I want you to help me polish this thing. How's the dialogue? Does it snap and crackle? Or, and this is one I've availed myself of more times than I can tell you, the writer will say, I want you to tell me what works. Tell me what you like and only what you like. I'd argue that this is, as needy as it sounds, a perfectly valid frame in which to put a piece of work. Recognizing when the buzzing of that neon sign is getting unmanageably loud, so loud that it threatens to drown out the quieter, more self-aware voices that are always there, if you can just hear them. This gives you a way to turn the voltage down and listen. You mentioned Harry Potter. I am not a Harry Potter guy. The more people who came up to me with that crazy pinwheel look in their eyes jabbering about, "Oh my God, have you read the Harry Potter books yet? You have to!" in that period when Harry Potter books were the thing, the more I reflexively refused to do that. We have a new puppy in the house, so I can tell you with some confidence this is exactly like what happens when you pull on her leash. The harder you pull, the harder she declines to be pulled. Yes, I am the puppy in this metaphor. However, I do know of Michael Gambon. I know him the way most grown-ass adult people know him, as the voice of Uncle Pastuso from the very excellent Paddington movies. And I've been thinking about his off-the-cuff review of you.
"Bloody brilliant. I couldn't fucking do that."
This is, it seems to me, an accidentally perfect, almost platonic ideal of a review. It does two things. It tells you right off the bat if the audience member was pleased with what he's seen, Gambon was, and then immediately acknowledges that the critic is not, himself, personally qualified to do the same. This is an admission that every critic ought to be forced to make. People talk about critical distance, and some examples of this are more extreme than others. You yourself talked about having had your show business performance critiqued by somebody who was more comfortable looking at comparable sales prices for condos. So there's something here I want to drill down on. There's no requirement, none, that a music critic know how to play a scale, or that a movie critic has ever looked through a camera, or that somebody who critiques variety acts, and surely there must be such a person, has ever picked up a set of juggling balls. I'm not saying this disqualifies them. I don't believe it does. But it's weird, right? I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill, why is my name in your 1940s hard-boiled detective novel, Chester? I don't hate it, but I am curious. I'm not a Harry Potter person either. When it first came out, just like you, I employed my usual tactic of the stubborn idiot of saying to myself, well, this seems to be almost universally popular and beloved, I'm out. I was forced a couple of Christmases ago by my wife and her mother to download the Harry Potter app and let it decide for me which house I belonged in. It does this by asking a series of moral questions, so I answered them and it told me that I was in something called Slytherin, which I assume is the best house because both my wife and her mother responded with, well, obviously. At this point, I'm very glad I didn't contribute to the author's vast fortune by buying any of her books, as she seems to have slowly revealed herself to be a hateful bag of crap. I wonder what house she's in. Anyway, transphobic wizard billionaires aside, you bring up a good point about critics and qualifications. I guess there are two parallel schools of thought. There's the layman approach, that a critic should be a fairly blank slate, just a normal audience member, without any particular knowledge or experience of what they're critiquing. That way, they can judge it in as honest a way as possible, without bringing any baggage to the work, and analyse it from the simple perspective of, did I enjoy that? That's one of those things that seems, on its face, to be fair and smart, but I think it's pretty obviously flawed. Let's say we're talking about opera, and we send a critic to an opera who has no particular knowledge, experience, or love of the art form. All they're going to be able to report back are the basics. Well, they sung everything. They sure have got some voices there. It wasn't short. Stuff like that. Which is helpful, I guess, but mostly helpful to people who probably wouldn't be interested in going to the opera in the first place or reading an opera review. An experienced reviewer would be able to talk about how the work succeeded or failed within its genre. They'd be writing for an audience who wanted to know if this was a good or interesting opera and why. As for my work, as we've discussed previously, it's in an odd place. I am, above all else, an entertainer, so I've always made sure that my work is populist and accessible to as many different kinds of people as possible. But at the same time, My genre is pretty niche, which means the number of critics who know the history of my art form and the lineage that I represent is slim. Which is why, if you're an Australian newspaper who sends a property writer to my show, she's going to flounder. Because aside from the fact that there seems to be an audience who seem to be enjoying it, she's not really sure what she's watching. This is sometimes annoying. I once read a review of a sideshow act wherein the writer said that the performer had juggled two balls and an apple and eaten the apple while juggling. He wrote how great this was and how he'd never seen anything like it before. The fact is, he was describing one of the most well-used and hack bits of business in any comedy juggler's repertoire. It was first created by British musical performer Monsieur Eddie Gray in about 1910 and has turned up in virtually every funny juggler's act over the decades since. It's basic, technically simple, and will pretty much guarantee laughs as it involves spitting mouthfuls of apple over the audience. It's fine, but it's old. That review was like going to the ballet and marvelling open-mouthed at how the dancers could stand on one leg. Someone who, for example, reviews movies doesn't have to have ever made one, but they should, I think it's fair to say, have seen a few. Bottom line, if you're going to review a very specific art form and you don't know very much about that art form and you don't admit that, then you're going to end up looking stupid. And of course, it wouldn't ever happen in opera or ballet or straight theatre. Those are respected, top-tier, grown-up culture. Genres like mine, they have a habit of falling through the cracks and ending up in basement venues, so they're sometimes seen as undeserving of serious study. Opera is a steak dinner. People like me are the candy by the checkout. Wait a minute. What's that buzzing? Oh, did someone turn on the neon sign of my parents' disapproval? Did I just end up veering dangerously near agreeing with them that what I do is of little worth? You take your eyes off the ball for 1 second and that's gonna happen. Let's just flick that switch back off again, shall we? Luckily, when I'm not feeling vulnerable, I am able to genuinely not care about the opinions of people who don't value what I do enough to look at it closely. Street performers learn to not waste energy trying to convince someone who is midway through walking away to stay. They won't. And even if they do, they're for sure not going to pay at the end of the show. The smart move is to let them go and concentrate on those that do stay. So I guess the same technique applies to one's internal critic. If it seems like it knows what it's talking about, then yeah, let it say its piece. But if it's just taking a dump on your pitch, you are allowed to ignore it. I hope the cruel city is sending enough mysterious dames to your office that you can keep the filing cabinet stocked with bourbon and bullets. I'll talk to you soon. Chester. Sorry, Matt.
Dear Matt, before I went to work at Newsweek, I was hired by the magazine to do a one-off freelance job. It involved pulling together some market research for a prospective mini-magazine covering higher education. This project was housed on the magazine's business, not editorial side, in the days when business and editorial were commonly referred to as having a church and state relationship. And I did it anonymously. It was a paycheck, not a byline. You have to understand, I was a person whose biggest accomplishment in college had been figuring out you could stick two rolling papers together to fashion a slower-burning, longer-lasting joint. You get what I'm saying. I was not an expert in the intricacies of academia. Which is how I came, in the course of my research, to misidentify the main campus of the University of Texas as Dallas. It was a sloppy mistake to make, but it wasn't an entirely unreasonable one. I'd simply misread the information at hand, and based on the knowledge set I had at the time, I didn't have any reason to suspect it. My research can't have been seen as too fatally flawed, though, because the magazine decided to go ahead with the supplement, and some months later, I landed the job as its first staff writer. For the next several years, whenever my boss, who had himself been an award-winning higher education writer, whenever my boss would get up ahead of steam about what nitwits they were over on the business side, he'd dust off the anecdote about the anonymous researcher who was so impossibly dim he didn't even know that when people talked about UT, they were almost invariably talking about the Austin campus. He was a good guy, my boss, and a mentor to me. I never had the heart to tell him. I bring this up now because In telling the story about the critic who thought he'd personally discovered what was actually the oldest trick in juggling, you've identified a pretty common phenomenon. The person, usually but not always a younger one, who's tasked with parsing a world he doesn't yet have the experience to interpret, but lacks the humility to know it. You know how every generation of music fans thinks it discovered ska? It's like that. And so I want to throw one more thing into the mix. Humility. Critics are experts for hire, and an essential part of expertise is knowing what you don't know. You've probably heard about the Dunning-Kruger effect. Dunning-Kruger is a cognitive bias in which people wrongly overestimate their knowledge or ability in a specific area. This tends to occur because a lack of self-awareness prevents them from accurately assessing their own skills. To simplify, it describes the situation in which an epic dumbass is too dumb to know how dumb he is. When coupled with toxic narcissism, you can end up dealing with a person who not only doesn't recognize his own dimness, he lacks even the baseline wit to recognize that he isn't the smartest guy in the room. This can be catastrophic, particularly if you imagine it applied to, say, I don't know, governance. Fortunately, in my country, we have a fully functioning system of participatory democracy, which ensures that such a person never, ever, ever has access to the levers of power. Again. My point is, humility is supremely important to a critic, and that includes a self-critic. When you hear that voice jumping the gun, putting your work to a scrutiny it's too early to sustain, it's time to pump the brakes. Humility is the brakes. It's the instinct that tells you you're not there yet. It's the voice that tells you creativity is elusive and difficult and takes time. It slows the onrushing of your thoughts to a speed where you can corral them. Humility, in tandem with its plodding but valuable cousin, experience, they're the things that allow you to place yourself accurately in a world that's vastly big and daunting, and push through, and keep going toward the point where your work can bear up to some stress testing. Then, and maybe only then, is it time to turn up the volume again. I hope you're plodding usefully on in your day over there, and I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill. Ah yes, the Dunning-Kruger effect. A concept famously created by David Dunning and Justin Kruger, who were the frontmen for New Hampshire's finest death metal polka fusion band, and who, after blaming their lack of mainstream chart success on the overinflated confidence of Timberlake, Gaga and Swift, retrained in psychology so they could over-rationalize their artistic failure. That may or may not be true. I got it from Russian Wikipedia, so, you know. As everyone listening to this will be well aware, while you have spent a lifetime dueling with the written word in the cerebral arena of the literati, I have spent my time in the tawdry world of grubby sequins, yellow spotlights and sticky stages. And in show business, the Dunning-Kruger effect is reflected in a funhouse mirror. And let's not forget that politics, as a million people have said before me, is just show business for ugly people. Someone who thinks they're more talented than they are? Someone for whom the internal voice of self-criticism gets drowned out by the background noise of canned applause? Someone who works in an industry where tangible skills can be way less important than a deranged level of self-belief? Someone too dumb to know how dumb they are, you say? Let me pose a question. Have you ever met a celebrity? I'm being unfair. But there is some truth to the statement that in show business, confidence is everything. Sometimes you don't need anything else except perhaps good bone structure or nice hair. That Dunning-Kruger effect is doing most of the heavy lifting for you. Humility? Humility is something your agent will get you pills to mitigate. I'm being unfair again. In the words of Martin Short, I kid because I love. I agree with you, though, that humility is kind of the useful bit of self-criticism. Humility is the feeling in the pit of your stomach that happens when you peer over the edge of a cliff, or the box that pops up on your screen saying, "Do you really want to delete that?" And if you have, over time, struck up a good relationship with it, then you might realise it's not saying, "Stop, idiot, you can't do this, give it up, go home, retrain." But it might be saying, "Wait, idiot, you can't do this yet, so let's make a to-do list and plan some stuff and then circle back around."
It's a speed bump. You know what we call speed bumps here in the UK? Sleeping policemen. This is true. And it seems like a risky thing to call something when you want people to slow down as they approach it. But regardless, once you've listened to what your humility is telling you and made your to-do list and got your ducks in a row, so to speak, once you're prepared, studied, practiced, dry cleaned, or you've done whatever you need to do to be as ready as you can be for whatever it is, then, as you say, you can turn things back to 11. You can thank humility for its feedback, but tell it that it can tag out now and let confidence, excitement, and even a little bit of ego take over. Because once humility has caused you to slow down, you need that confidence to put a spring back in your step. It is, like absolutely everything else, a combination of balance and luck. Hopefully, as you gain experience and knowledge in your field, you get better and better at detecting if the voice in your head delivering running commentary of your failings is making good points or just being a dick. So at least some of the time, you'll know when to pay attention and when to tell it to shush. But here's my thinking. If in doubt, err on the side of ignoring it. I figure that if you take all of your self-criticism to heart, there's much less chance you'll actually make or do anything, so you'll never know if it was right or not. But if, when you're unsure, you just steam ahead and do it anyway, well, you'll probably end up finding out if your thing was any good, because other people will tell you. Maybe it's not smart to make a creative decision on the unasked-for opinions of just one person, even if that person lives in the back of your head. And as I type that, that very voice in my head is telling me what a stupid, badly thought-out idea it is, but I'm going to go ahead and ignore that and see what other people think. I'm sure they'll tell me. I hope the voice in your head isn't being too much of a dick. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barol in the US and Matt Ricardo in the UK, with audio production by Bill Barol. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.